How's the practicum experience working out? It means it's working. It means you're actually conscious of your... we did is we... Those who aren't here, I gave people a band. Every time they criticize, they want to criticize. They have to try not... And every time they criticize, they have to change the band on their hand. And what that does is, when you're about to criticize, and to keep it on your hands for 3 weeks, then I explain to them how, according to yoga psychology, how your habit will be changed from the bad habit of criticizing to the good habit of not criticizing. So it's an amazing thing, because as soon as you're conscious now, you're in your Buddha, your intelligence, as soon as you think of
it. It totally worked for me, like, this morning, and I was like,
I thought I was a saint, and I was like working on it all day. If I didn't have this, man. And you see, it's born from a klishta vritti, a thought that's detrimental to yoga, which is the evolvement of the mind. So it's really, yes.
The foot of thought is tricky, because I find that I can be critical of my thoughts and not express.
Yeah.
And so is that like a loophole?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't. So should I switch my band when I have critical thoughts?
No, only when you say it.
Okay.
You see, because the thoughts are going to come.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, not acting on them. It's just what I was saying. If you don't act, it's so simple, right? Your mind is, I like this, right now as an impression in the mind that wants to be filled with the same thing. And we can like good things, we can like bad things, we can have good, can have a klishta with these or klishta. And then reverse the good things or bad things. So anyway, this thing, to criticize, born of that heart of ego or envy or reality or whatever it is, it's not a good samskara. So what happens is, when you come into contact with an object of, let's say in this case, criticism, something you like to criticize, the thought will come. But the question is not acting on the thought. Right? And if you don't act on it, then these samskaras will get smaller. It doesn't mean we do have to criticize in another way, practically. We do manage, we do teach, we are, we have children, but it's when it's born of something that's unhealthy. So that was kind of interesting. So I think it'll carry the class on further. I just wanted to mention too, is that what I'm going to do maybe during the break, is I'll have a list. If anybody wants to be on my mailing list, and therefore when I give talks within the city, you'll know, not just at Yoga Maya, other places, you'll know. Also, so you can put your name on the list, and if you want to put a check by your name, then I can also inform you of mailings on my website of writings and talks. I give actually 2 talks a week on the phone, basically, to phone conferences on different subjects. And they're also downloaded, so those things can be there. I'll also hand out my, because people ask me for my email or address, I'll hand out my, for my birthday, someone got me a, I never had one before, but for my birthday, someone got me my car. That thing. And this is actually from a wall in Vrindavan, where they write a very saintly graffiti artist, an old sadhana, writes there. Okay, those things are there. Now, we're going to cover the second section today. There's four paras, but the first two are the most relevant. So, the first was look for those who had really controlled their mind. Because it took a great degree of sattva to meditate on the level that they were discussing. And we also discussed, even though it was for those who controlled the mind, there's so many practical principles in there that we actually kind of gleaned in terms of yoga, psychology, and how the mind works, you know, etc. So I think it still had value. Now this is going to discuss more for those whose minds have not yet gotten that level of sattva or purity. And that, therefore, it's a little bit more action-orientated yoga that's going to be mentioned. And it's called Kriya Yoga. And Kriya Yoga, the path of action consists of three things, which we'll discuss: self-discipline, which is tapa or austerity, swayaya, study, and Ishvara Pranidhani, submission to God, which is mentioned again. And these are not options. When Ishvara Pranidhan was mentioned in the first chapter, worship of God, it was mentioned as an object of meditation. Here it's a little bit different. It's in terms of how you work within the world, how you act within the world. Anyway, we're going to discuss those. And also, really, you know, this is all about relieving suffering. Because that's why people have faith in things and what they do. We discussed a very nice definition of faith. The Sanskrit word for faith is shraddha. And shraddha means trust, but it's a trust in where your sublimity lies, where it rests. And we discussed how important it is to have trust in the right things that actually can remove suffering and give you happiness, and how being born in a culture that's not so thoroughly couched in understanding and knowledge, where we're taught to have faith in so many things as our objectives in life that give us a temporary pleasure, but they don't actually elevate the mind. And this is very important to understand in terms of happiness, that there are things that give us pleasure, but they don't evolve the consciousness, they degrade the consciousness. So ultimately, they give you a momentary thing, but your consciousness and your level of happiness and contentment actually goes down. It doesn't mean that there aren't things that are pleasurable that can elevate the consciousness. But the point is that the proper society, the proper culture needs knowledge. You have to know what to do. That's why you're here. And then you need, also again, dispassion. You have to have some control, some self-discipline. You have to know what to do, and you have to know how to do it. You have to be able to do it. So it's really a very rich text, and it's giving us some very basic principles in understanding this. But, you know, so... So this first part, you know, basically from verse 1 or 2 to 14, I'll go over this. It's really going to talk about the immediate causes of suffering and their psychological effect, which is called the kleshas. There's vrittis. And again, I gave a little background, but don't worry, the terms will come up again and again. You know, vrittis are the thoughts, but the thoughts are based on core psychological states of the mind. which we're going to go over. I'll just repeat them briefly. There's avidya, ignorance, asmita, which is the ego based on ignorance, and one leads to another, and then there's the attachment, the aversion, and the clinging to life. But there's a certain psychological klesha, means trouble. Anything that degrades the mind is trouble. Anything that evolves the mind is not trouble. And so many people are running around for happiness without any cognizance that it's about the mind. It's about the mind. It's not just about the sense objects. It's about the mind. That story of the Dalai Lama when he went to Switzerland. And when he went to Switzerland and they gave him a penthouse apartment. He had a view, right? A lot of airspace in that apartment. You know, in New York, you not only buy the apartment, but how much space you get between the next apartment. He had a free brain. And they said to him, wow, must have been a guy from New York. Wow, isn't this wonderful? And he said, I don't know, if I was depressed, I would jump out. Right? So these simple understandings that were imbibed in a culture of spirituality, you know, where you're concerned with the what something does to the mind, not just something that conforms to your desires. And there's, you know, it's not that a very good part of spiritual philosophy is how to satisfy your desires so the mind won't be frustrated and you can be peaceful. But that's not the objective. And it's not an absolute correlation. When I was studying aeronautics. That was a joke I made yesterday. I was studying philosophy but still taking up space in the 60s. And I had a hedonist for a philosophy professor. And he just said that happiness is the pleasure of the senses. I raised my hand. He said, yes. I said, if happiness is the pleasure of the senses, can you cure depression by giving someone an ice cream cone? There's not an absolute correlation, actually. So it's this evolvement of the mind. And that's why I like this text, how it presents the mind and the profundity of the mind. And again, the mind is that lens. And if you can control your mind, which is these vrittis and thoughts, you can control them, then you can elevate them, you can quell them, you can elevate the mind, and just like a mirror. Look at the reflection now. Look at the reflection now. Look, now you have the right with them. When you actually see what's there, then that's what's success. Such a beautiful concept. One great teacher in our tradition wrote a book called Reality is Beautiful. If you actually see what's there. You can't see what's there if your lens is not clean, if your lens is distorted. So this is such a... And it's so surprising how this type of knowledge is just not any more imbued in the tradition and the culture. Somehow we think, what's our thoughts if in the future... If the world can conform to my desire and it's perfectly lined up, the mate I want, the money I want, the respect I want, the place I want, right? Not thinking about the mind I want, not thinking about the consciousness I want. And what this is going to show you, too, is like you have to move towards that. Now, again, this is an ascetic text. It's talking to people who are renouncing the world, it's not even the path that ascetics start with. And in certain paths, like bhakti, it's not even the goal to renounce everything like that. It's dedication of everything. But it all has core philosophical concepts that your ultimate happiness is going to be based on the involvement of your consciousness. And you should be sensitive to how things affect that in a very, very practical way. Any questions? Yes.
I know that this you're not of the ascetic.
Well, I am, well, actually. I have to say this. In the bhakti tradition, I'm of the ascetic path. But it's just a personal proclivity I have. It does in our path. It's not... I'm a monk, a celibate monk.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are married. But bhakti itself is dedication. Rather than renunciation, it's dedication. But that's also renounced, because you give up the things you can't dedicate. But anyway.
Well, my question about about this philosophy is, doesn't it, to some degree, sort of reject reality in the sense of the human experience, in a way?
Well, what this philosophy says, at least what this philosophy says, right, is that experience, right, in one sense, in this philosophy, it may be real, right, but the illusion is your identification with it, right? It's like if there's a rope and you see it as a snake, it's not that the rope doesn't exist, it doesn't that the snake doesn't exist, it's just that you have a wrong conception of it. So I won't think it rejects reality. And I think on the other hand too, if you talk about this is for ascetics, this is for people who've for people who are free really from these desires. And it's very—they're free from any selfish desire, right? It's not, it does. Yeah, this is ascetic. The yogic path believes that you should stop all. That yoga means yoga chitta vritti nirodha. You stop it, and obviously they don't believe that that's unreal. They believe that enables you to actually see what's real. Like here, it's going to say one of the niyams is celibacy, complete celibacy. Bhagavad Gita, it would say, dharma virute bhuteshu kamasya, that I am sex life according to spirituality, which means committed. Probably the highest level just for children, but at least committed relationship. There's always restriction in any spiritual path, generally, of indulgence in desires. Because why? You can see it. If you're just going to follow your desires, how are you... In other words, remember the flow of consciousness it described? In yoga, what's the flow of consciousness? It's like a river, one or two ways. Either I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this, or when you control it, the consciousness is going to flow in the inner self, in the soul. And they believe that's reality. That's the real you. And if you're identifying with this, and again, I'm presenting what the yoga philosophy is. And I told you, some of the things that I'm not quite understanding is the complete dislocation of the soul from the body and the mind. Or of the thoughts, the will, the determination. They believe it's just within buddhi, the material mind. It has nothing to do with the consciousness, etc. So that's what their philosophy is. Now, what do you define as the human experience? And
I guess what I am having a problem with, or not a problem, but I just have been thinking about, is there a way to sort of come to this understanding but still be of this sort of...
Yeah, we're going to discuss that. That's the next... That's bhakti.
Okay.
this is something that to perfect in this type of approach. But, you know, again, they talked about Ishvara Pranidhan, right? They talked about the worship of God and how you can achieve the result just by that. And this chapter is at least going to describe spirituality for people, you know, in the world, in that kind of thing. But in the yoga process, that's the goal. The goal is to give up all this and sit and meditate. And if you want that as your path, then there's celibacy 100%. You know, you're out of society if you renounced everything, and that's what it is. Yeah, I don't think it's like a problem with it. Well, it's for certain types of people.
Right. I was going to say I don't really have a problem with it. I just don't think, like, for me, that's personally not. You know, it doesn't feel like that's my path. But I think that there can be many paths.
There's different paths, but there are certain truths that I'm trying to present that are universal in they're cutting through all different paths.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Yes?
One follow-up on Ali's question is these people that this is guided towards, are they people who've already lived a little bit of life? Because in order for, I think it sounds like what you might have been tapping into is, in order to be able to digest the instructions of what to do and what not to do, you actually have to have just a tiny bit of life experience to have been exposed to the quandaries of
it's you know, it's again, people have different types of samskaras. They have different types of desires within them, right? And as it's reincarnation, different people start at different levels of spiritual evolvement. So, you know, a person can start from a very young, like a Dalai Lama. It could be from, you know, past life. You know, but generally speaking, even in yoga, you don't start at this, you start at karma yoga. In other words, you start with working through your desires. And the whole system is this. The idea is to give up all selfish desires. Right? Not necessarily in spirit, there's different paths. It's not necessarily to give up the objects. It's to give up the conceptions of possessiveness and selfishness, etc. But if you're talking about a classical ascetic path, you know, the desert monks, etc., like that. The question you're really asking is, can we stay where we are, or do we have to work through it? In other words, I think the question you're asking, this is an ascetic, is that the objective or goal that we want? Right? That's one object. Well, this is the goal, the objective we want. Right? This is the goal, to be an ascetic, to give it all up, to give all thoughts, etc. That's one option here. You know, another option would be, that's the goal, and I work through it. Or maybe that's not the goal. Maybe the goal is to refine human experience. You know, so these are different options that people, I think it'll become clear when we discuss the various things here. But like I said, you know, I'm kind of a monk in a different tradition, and I like to make jokes. So it's fine. You know, in my tradition, in bhakti, because it's dedication, it's not giving up objects. It's changing your relationship with them. Right? Just like these beautiful flowers were brought by different students here. You know, wonderful, right? And I said to them, I'll explain to you why it's so nice, because at least in the yoga of devotion, right, how do you express love? Love is to please. And how do you please someone? You give them the best. What does that mean? The best sights, the best fragrances, the best tastes. That's how love is communicated. So flowers are very beautiful and they're very fragrant, so they're an expression of love. And it's nice in a culture in those exchanges. Okay, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to the text now. Unless you want to hear the continuing story of my spiritual outreach in Alabama. Because it continued. I just got a copy of the note that the father of the family sent to all the family about the wonderful experience of me being there. And how his conclusion was that actually Christianity is an Eastern tradition. And that Jesus got his teachings when he was in India, when he disappeared.
There's entire books about that.
I know, that was his conclusion. But his conclusion was that Jesus was the ultimate guru. That's not fine. Okay, ready? Okay, let's discuss now, okay? We're going to go through the text. Okay, so Kriya Yoga, yoga of action. So, the goal is this, in yoga, is this to cause the vrittis to subdue, and you attain this state where you're dwelling within yourself, your own consciousness, right? Again, this is the soul, the purusha, this is the mind and the body, and the goal is this samadhi. And what is this samadhi? Either when the mind becomes so pure that it can perfectly reflect the soul, that was called samprajnata samadhi, or the mind actually dissolves and the soul is just, it's not having any object except itself. And that was called asamprajnata samadhi. That was the seventh and highest stage of yoga. Okay, so that was the goal. So to do that, the vrittis have to be quelled. The thoughts have to be quelled. So now what it's discussing in this chapter, for those who are not controlled, how do you deal with the underpinnings of all the thought processes so that one can quiet the mind even when you're in an active state? Right, so he describes, it says, practice and dispassion, because in the first chapter, right, it said, well, how do you practice this yoga? You can achieve it by practice and dispassion. Practice means that you concentrate the mind on one thing, and dispassion means is that you develop a temperament of renunciation. But he says this requires a predominance of sattva, of goodness. So it's difficult for the active and outgoing mind that's still under the influence of the rajas, the passion, the intense activity, and the inertia, the tamas, the ignorance. He said, for such a temperament, the means outlined in this sutra produce the required purity of mind. It's not to say that the abhyasa, the practice, and the vairagya, the dispassion, are not to be cultivated even at the beginning in yoga, but that the sattva, that purified mind, is especially easily cultivated through this kriya yoga, this more active control of the mind by practicing austerity, self-study, and worshiping God. Right? So, of course, and once the mind becomes more sattvic, then one's meditation increases. And whether that's your goal or not, to quell the mind will bring you to a higher level of perception and contentment. And who doesn't want whether you're active in the world or not. So whether you're going for that ultimate goal in yoga or whether you just want a higher level of contentment and perception. You know, these are very important things and very important knowledge. Okay, so they quote the Gita. Action is said to be the means for the sage desires of yoga, and for one who's already attained yoga, tranquility is said to be the means. So, action is the means for people who are desirous. And one who's quelled the mind, then tranquility is the thing. So, Patanjali is now presenting a more accessible and action-oriented method for approaching the goals outlined in the previous chapter. Okay? We had a lot of fun yesterday. I'll try to keep that up, but I think I paid the price that I can be a little bit more demanding and scholarly in this class. Here. Not that the other one wasn't. But okay, so there's three things. First is tapa. And tapa means heat, friction, pain, discomfort. It means a voluntary acceptance of simplicity or some things that you do in your life for a spiritual purification that are a little bit difficult for the body, but have a spiritual objective. My teacher, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, gave a good definition of tapa. The voluntary acceptance of difficulty in the pursuit of a spiritual goal. Or another way you can look at it, despite the irrational impulses of the mind and the senses, you know, you have a kind of practice and a spirituality. And, you know, you know, it's a certain way to eat, a certain type of discipline. A different commentary is have it, you know, in different ways. What can do? It's not the tendency of like arduous austerities. Like there's one austerity that people stay in the middle of a fire in the summer. And in cold water in the winter, actually speaking, it's not these kinds of, you see these sometimes in India, arduous, because it's not about disturbing the mind. It's got to be regulated or prescribed, but it's real healthy. I'll give you just a practical example of how it works, right? And the benefit of it. You know, I went to India in 1976. And it was so austere. Yeah, you can't. And now, when Julie and Lisa Bermudez visited me in Vrindavan, it was like a paradise. Right? Coming back here was an austerity, right? Going up to that nice restaurant every day, sitting at the tables with your friends, and, you know, going out to the woods with me, to the little sadhus in the woods that their wives are cooking those fresh hot breads right off the stove with the, you know, it's, you know, better phone reception there than here. After going and seeing the airport in Delhi, and then when I flew into LaGuardia, I went like this, my God, this is India 30 years ago. But when I went to India, it was austere. You know, the place I live had the highest recorded temperature in an inhabited place in the Guinness Book of World Records. So I was living in the heat. You can't believe what that heat is. And there wasn't enough electricity. So everybody uses electricity when it's hot. So you get it periodic. I would sleep on the floor with a bucket and a cloth, a gumsha, I put the bucket, the gumsha means like a kind of a cloth that, you know, you cut for drying your body, like a thin towel. Put it in the water. I put it over myself. Within 2 seconds, it was so hot. The winter, it was near freezing. No heat in the building. Ice cold water. And I'm a monk. I take a shower at like 4 o'clock in the morning. Ice cold, and look forward to it. And then if the sun doesn't come out, and then there were like so many, and at that time, you know, anyway, there were diseases, and there was so much austerity, but I wasn't making it artificially, but I had a mission, I had a service, I was doing things spiritually and altruistically. So interesting thing, I just show you how it works. When I came back to America and my father said, you know, you want to take me to the dentist in Brooklyn, I lived in Brooklyn, and I remember my father's friend, I know exactly what he looks like, I liked his name was Mickey Seltzer. And and at that time, when you got your teeth drilled, there was no.
Oh.
And what you would do is, it's like a water drill. And he said, press your hand when it's too much pain. Okay? So he was doing it, and he was pressing the hand. You know, he was going like this. And he's kind of looking at me, but I wasn't pressing the hand. Mm. You know? And then I realized, because I was performing these austerities, what happens is, it's kind of like this. Here's the mind and all the torment of all the desires and the fluctuations and the desires and the angers and the revenge and all the things we have that disturb us and that distort our vision of things. What happens is because this connection of the pure soul with the mind is very much because we want to be the center and the enjoyer, the controller, and the ego, right? So the more you act on that platform, like if you indulge yourself, this is an interesting thing. If you indulge yourself in the mind and the body without any restriction, without any principles, the conception, it's only a mental conception actually. It's not a real connection, it's a mental conception. That conception gets stronger and stronger and stronger. So actually speaking, in the name of unrestricted life, without any reasonable simplicity, I was just thinking, you know, previously, and I was out in that farm in Pennsylvania, and you turn on the water, and the hot water comes down, and you go, ah, right? You know, previously I said, how did people live? They didn't have this before, right? How did they live? Well, they had a simple life, and it was a simple life that entailed some austerity. But it made them happier, actually speaking, because it abstracted them to a certain extent from all this. Right? So if you're in a cult, you know, okay, another example there. And then I went home, and then the air conditioner broke in the house, and my mother, from Brooklyn, said, I'm dying. I'm dying. Right? I'm dying. Yeah, I so what? You know? It's just, you know, so when you live a life where you learn to tolerate a bit, you know, not just completely have to adjust to every, you know, hot, cold. You know, everything in our life, then you just you become more absorbed in that bodily concept of life, and you feel the pains, the pleasures and pains of the world more acutely. But here's the key: And just think about, I explained it, yes, a pinch of suffering is felt more than a ton of happiness. So when you just make that your objective and move and adjust, you know, rather than live simply and make some type of austerity in your life, like here it's mentioned, you know, even speaking truthfully, this is an austerity here. Right here, it's an austerity. What we're doing. Anybody wasn't here yesterday? Okay. You're here? If you come during the break for a few minutes, I'll show you how this works, because it's very interesting. But there's a whole class on it. It's very interesting. So, just in terms of tapa means the control of the senses, controlling the quantity, food, the quality of what one listens to or reads or talks about. You know, so there's a simplicity of life. It's very, very helpful. And I'm seeing too, you know, I don't live that way anymore. But you see, the thing is also, is, I mean, if you want to look at it realistically, no matter how much you adjust everything in this world, no matter how much you adjust everything in this world, then ultimately what happens? You die. And if you don't become extracted from that, so, you know, simplicity. And then I think I'm a bit, because I've lived a kind of life, and again, it doesn't have to be an aesthetic, just talking about people in the world, but because I live that kind of life, I'm not as affected by people about it's hot or it's cold. You know, but when you're in that consciousness, you know, everything is not exactly your thing. And if that's your consciousness, you're completely moved every moment by these dualities, hot, it's cold, they like, I don't know. It's not a happy life. You have to be somewhat abstracted and detached. Why? Because we are not the controllers of the world and things don't move our way. Right, Lisa? Right? It doesn't... Right? It doesn't move our way. She was at the hurricane? Yeah, affected your house and things like that. And you know, it's okay. Naturally, we're going to feel an attachment, but that's the way the world is. You have to become... So that's austerity. But not... It's not to be overdone. They're not talking about these arduous austerities. They're thinking about simple living. High thinking. Yeah.
So is that the same ideas as when you're sitting in meditation and like you're... Hips hurt, or like your knee hurts.
To a certain extent, yeah. That's also, there's so many types of things, right? Yeah. Even in exercise, you know, people push themselves. It's good for their mind because they can't, you know, they have to extract themselves to go through it. So they do feel a certain type of peacefulness. Like that. Just that principle is there. Yes?
I was just thinking about the sound yesterday.
The what?
It's the sound that I live with in my life.
That the what?
The sound that I live with every day in my life.
Yeah.
That sound next door didn't touch me. It didn't affect me at all. And I could stay focused.
Yeah.
That's because I live with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of other people were just kind of like, I don't know what to do with this sound. There are many things I can get through. That's
what you're saying is a point. New York can be an austerity. Sure.
Yeah.
I generally, in India, it's worse.
Okay.
And I learned to be very tolerant of sound, but at the same time, because of the speaking, it requires a little. Yeah, good. Thank you. Okay, well, let's go on now. So then there's austerity, and then there's study. And it means study of these sacred texts, and it also means recitation of mantras. And what's the connection between studying sacred texts and the recitation of mantras? The connection is generally a sacred text reveals to you a form of the divine which you are connected with. And then the method to realize it, which is the recitation of mantras. So here, this is like a very out-in-the-world practice. Some austerity, you know, not living just a ridiculously indulgent life, just moving every moment according to each desire for your happiness, but living a little bit more tolerant and detached. Now, I try to be that way, you know, and, you know, there was also something, I forgot where it was, maybe it comes up later, it comes up in contentment in one of the niyams. And, you know, you have a certain allotment by God, and it's enough. Not always coveting, wanting more, moving this way. What here is giving you keys to end suffering and to become more happy. It's giving you practical knowledge of how you live in the world in that way. And it says here, they will say, no tapa, no yoga. That's it. You're not going to quell the mind unless you perform some austerity. Tolerance of extreme, control of intake of food, performance of your duty, your responsibilities in the world. Be responsible person in the world. You know, all these things are just healthy to get you away from this absolute union with the body and mind, which is transforming and which will go at one time. You know, when I was in that place in Alabama and I was speaking, you know, one of the things I spoke about is death and how a spiritual person is not disturbed by it. And I was there when my teacher passed away and he came to leave the world. He said, what is death but a change of body? And I was there. I was at his bed when he passed away. Because he didn't live a life of this absolute identification with everything. And so there's some... It's healthy to have some abstraction. It's healthy to have some abstraction by some spiritualized, some spiritual practices, by some moral obligations. You know, who has read the author called Tom Wolfe? Okay, I think he's the New York Magazine, great writer. He wrote an article of satire on my generation. You know, my father's generation was called the greatest generation. You know, they went to the war. They fought. You know, my generation is called the me generation. Hippie generation. Me. And he made a point. They never understood duty above self. Duty above self. So it's a more active thing within the world. And then, okay. I'm losing my place here. Okay. Okay. And then, again, Ishvara Pranidhan is mentioned. And it's more kind of than the... when it's mentioning here to submit to God, the first one in the first chapter is as an object of meditation. Here it's more action-oriented. And it gives a verse from the Bhagavad Gita, which is classic in that, which says, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you give away, whatever austerity you perform, do it as an offering to me. You do things as an offering to God. And sometimes you do it as an offering to God by doing the things you like to do, but somehow making the offer purify. Even working and giving some charity or doing things in that consciousness, you know, in India, when you eat food, rather than, you know, because rather than develop the consciousness of just my own tastes, you know, that's why I have these deities. And we'll talk about it when I do the bhakti thing. Food is offered with love and devotion. You know, you do it in the sense of pleasing God. And you take it as God's mercy. And things like this. This is, as I told you, it's theistic. And not only out of duty, but out of love. Not only doing things because you have to do them, because doing it as an offering of devotion to God, with devotion. So this is okay. So that's that's called Kriya Yoga. So what are the three things in Kriya Yoga? Tapa means what? Austerity. Tapa. Swadhyaya means what? Study of sacred texts and recitation of mantras. And Ishvara Pranidhana. To submit, to worship God. So it's interesting here, it's mentioned as an absolute requirement here. To proceed even to the meditational process. India is a very theistic country. This is born within India. People worship God. It's just... okay. Okay, verse 2. Samadhi Bhavanartha Klesha Tanu. Kalanartascha. This yoga of action is for bringing about samadhi and for weakening the afflictions to yoga. So it's in the world, but the objective is to actually be able to do yoga and to purify yourself. And it's for that and for weakening the kleshas, the obstacles to yoga. And kleshas are just obstacles, impediments. And they're the roots of the thoughts. You want to get to the, you want to quell the thoughts, you got to get to the roots. And what are the roots of the thoughts? They're called kleshas, and it describes exactly what there is, what they are. And it's interesting too. It's not just the theoretical reading of this of the text, it's actually applying the knowledge. And without applying the knowledge, it will not remove these impediments to yoga. There will be no realization of it. I hold a retreat every year in India at a very holy place called Puri. And it's wonderful. It's just, it's paradise. It's by the ocean. I can't explain how beautiful this is. So somehow or other, one of the foremost saints in India of our tradition contacts me that he wants to come to my retreat. He does it every year. You know, he does it every year. So he came, and this person is like, wow, he's amazing. And he came, and he's very, very learned, but he's very, very humble. So he looks, and in my retreat, I mean, this year there was 125 people. I don't want to ruin any of the things, but we don't charge. We just do it by donation, because then we keep. I mean, you have to charge, and we actually had to make some adjustments, but I got some patrons and donors, this whole thing, but you got to pay for your rooms, but beyond that, beautiful rooms, real clean. $8 a day. Share the rooms, $4 a day. So, he's there, and coming are these people from the Sanskrit school where I live. And they're sitting there in the front. So he says, who is Shastra-ya? Who knows the sacred texts? Right? Who knows these teachings? And I can never forget his report. He looked for the answer and then he went, one who practices. So this is the application. When you apply something, you realize it, and then you get the fruit of it. And when you can get to these obstacles, they're the root of the selfishness that creates the karma. Right? We have a stock of karma that's coming. We never know what's going to happen. But it's all destined. A certain amount has been put in this life to give us the experiences we need to actually become more spiritually fit and more aware of God. I'm going to give... Would some of you come to lecture if I give it in July?
Yeah.
The Psychology of Karma. We work with an astrologer. Yeah, I'll give that one. We'll do that in July. It's very interesting. Because it's all... So you know what it's complicated science, but I'll tell one story about karma. Okay, it's coming. I mean, wow, good and bad. That's why you have to be detached, because good will come now, bad will come now. One saint told me, one who is fortunate, one who is unfortunate. Will be fortunate. One who's fortunate will be unfortunate. If you're simply in that consciousness of this intense desire just to, you know, that your happiness is just controlling the world according to your desires, you wind up frustrated. Because it comes, it goes. It comes, it goes. It switches in here. And if that's your concept of happiness, it's happiness and distress and happiness. Yeah, I went through very difficult periods. On that level. Even while I was pursuing spiritual life, things didn't go my way. Now they're going nicer. But I'm trying to become detached. I'm trying not to make my happiness, you know, how things move around my desires. I'm trying to make it consciousness. So, this book keeps on moving. Do you see how calm it was? I get disturbed. Okay. Now these are the kleshas. Okay? The impediments to samadhi are ignorance, ego, attachment, aversion, clinging to life. So ignorance is the root. Right? And ignorance is going to be defined as this identification. When you think that the mind and senses are you. So we're talking about karma, right? So that's karma. And the underpinning of it are these kleshas. And it's ignorance. So if you don't have knowledge, you cannot uproot the psychological underpinnings that are the cause of all your... there's going to be one verse coming up, is that suffering in the future can be counteracted. You can't counteract the suffering that happened in the past, you can't have the suffering that's now, but the future can be. So you got to, so knowledge will counteract it. So it said, now we'll just go to four. Ignorance is the breeding ground of the other kleshas, whether they are in a dormant, weak, intermittent, or fully activated state. These, you can read the technicalities, but I can say, but dormant means that they're there. You have attachments, but they're not always disturbed, right? You may have an attachment to something, it's not disturbed. And active, it's there. Intermediate. Well, sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. You know, so a man is attached to this woman, and then he sees another woman. Doesn't mean he's still not attached to that woman, but he's forgotten. It goes, so like this. But ignorance is the breeding ground. And then he defines ignorance. So what is ignorance? It's avidya. A in Sanskrit means to negate. A means to negate. Right? So avidya means not having knowledge. And so what it says, the opposite. And that means that our conventional awareness and thoughts, which I would basically put, if you look at it, we have a desire and we see everything as objects for our desire. Right? That's material. That kind of putting ourselves in the center and seeing everything as objects for us. By the way, that's a platform where love cannot flow to the heart. So that kind of conventional awareness is the exact opposite of true knowledge. So here's what it says. Ignorance is the notion that takes the self, which is joyful, pure, and eternal, to be the non-self, which is painful, unclean, and temporary. So the self is eternal. So if we think, this is me, we're identifying with what's not us because we're eternal. And it's painful. And unclean. And it's unclean. Its origin, it's, where does it come from? It comes from an unclean place. It's sustenance. It's excretions. That it continually needs to be clean. This is right now. I have to say that while there's a commonality, not all schools of thought have such a negative conception of the body. You see my tilak here. I got this little clay here. It's on 12 parts of my body. After I take bath, it's from a sacred river. I chant Om Keshavaya Namaha, Om Narayana Namaha, Madhavaya Namaha, Govindanaya Namaha, Om Vishnuvaya Namaha, Om Adasudha Namaha, Om Chukmaya Namaha, Om Vamanam. It's, I'm chanting names of God. I'm looking more at my body as a temple of God. There's a few little different conceptions and ideas, but basically it also is true. There's a famous story of the body where this licentious man becomes attached to this married woman, and she's beautiful. So he propositions her. A famous story, maybe. He propositions her. And she says, she's very humble and saintly, but she's so beautiful, so young. And he says, I will satisfy you, come back in a week. So for a week, she takes all kinds of purgatives and she does punch karma. You know what that is in India. Purify your body. Anyway. and therefore she becomes emaciated and weak. And he comes back, and he said, I want to see that woman. She said, I am there. He says, where's your beauty? And she goes in the next room, and she saved all the stuff. Famous story. So that's what ignorance is. It's that identification. Okay. You know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to finish defining the kleshas, what they are, and then we'll take a short break. Right, maybe 5 minutes. You know, just to, and then someone could say if they want a little air in here. I don't know. I've lived in India.
Are you okay?
What?
Are you okay with the temperature?
I'll be okay with anything because I lived in India, so if I have cold, it doesn't disturb me. I'm trained that way, but I do feel that we. See, to me, renunciation means to give to things that have no value. So if you need temperature to function better, then you can take a consensus among yourselves and then figure it out. I have no qualms if you want to put on the fans or the air conditioner or something. But hey, the spring is coming. That's pretty exciting. Okay, so then I guess we got to, 7 at night. So basically we've been going for almost an hour and a half, which at the beginning is not so bad. So we'll take a little short break and then we can go again to about 3:30 or something, or 4, and then we can take the half hour break, and then like that. I get more breaks. Okay. Asmita, ego is to consider the nature of the seer and the nature of the instrument power of seeing is the same. So this is a little different than a video. Just listen carefully. So the seer means the soul, and the instrumental power of seeing, it basically says, it refers to when the ego is when you think this is exactly the same as this. Now the difference with ignorance is, the difference between this and ignorance is just a general conception that this is this. And asmita, the ego, is the more specific conception that I am man, I am woman, I am American, I am Indian, I am black, I am white, I am... It's that kind of conception.
You could even take it out to I am my feelings.
What?
You could take it out to I am my feelings.
Yeah, a little bit more specific,
yeah.
Right, of this thing. So that's asmita. It's kind of like if you mistake the spectacle for the eyes, right? See, it's kind of the instrument of seeing to be the actual eyes. So this is actually this is the awareness, this is just material. But if you...
I feel like the brain for the thoughts.
Kind of. if you take this... You know, the soul is seen through the lens of the mind, and the mind is transforming, and the mind has all these ideas, and you start to think that this is yourself. The limited consciousness reflected into this kind of sphere and all those things. So that's another clay, that's another obstacle. It's more concrete and more specific. And just ignorance. Attachment stems from experiences of happiness. So the third klesha means attachment means the remembrance of your past experiences. Right? I enjoyed this, now I'm attached to this. I enjoyed this, now I'm attached to this. I enjoyed this, now I'm attached to this. Okay, so that's your attachments. Then aversion is your, basically the same thing, but your remembrances of what you don't like. What gave you pain? And moving according to these in a selfish way is what causes karma. Karma is the reaction of the consciousness that's against the soul and against our nature, which is to be selfish and like that. And therefore there's reactions to that that purify us that. And we've been in the world since time immemorial. We don't know what's coming. But when you're a spiritual person and it comes, you'll understand how to read it in a way that you'll see it for your benefit, even if it's causing difficulty in various ways. But that's another class. And then finally, and this is interesting too, the tendency of clinging to life affects even the wise. It's an inherent tendency. So that the whole fact, there's a book I mentioned by Ernest Becker, I think his name, I forgot his name, but it's called Denial of Death, how so much of our selfishness is this intense desire to cling to this particular temporary encasement. And what we do to try to immortalize this in terms of our power, in terms of our attachments to so many things. So it's also against yoga. And then what he says is, it means fear of death. Spiritual persons lose fear of death. In fact, the main text in our tradition is based on the question, if you want to be fearless at the time of death, what is the duty of a man who is about to die, and what should he not do? It's such a big thing, that junction, because it's a junction, a stepping a platform for our next destination. In Sanskrit, there's two things. One is called Brahmana, means a broad-minded person, and one is called Kripana. So what is a Kripana? A Kripana is, he has dysentery, he goes to the restaurant, and he orders calzones, and lasagna, and chocolate cake, and he's thinking, my life starts at the beginning of the meal, and it ends at the end of the meal, I'm okay. He doesn't see beyond that. So a broad person, right, sees, well, I'm not just this beginning of the meal and the end of the meal. I have a life afterwards, and if I'm not very, very careful, I'll get sick. So a broad-minded person just doesn't see in terms of this life. They see the effect of the future life and what will happen to one. So this clinging to life, it's a very nice, he gives, even a newly born worm is afraid of death, the Chaspati Mishra argues. He says that, therefore, clinging to life, this fear cannot be explained by the standard means of attaining knowledge. Why this fear, even of a worm? It means they've experienced it in the past. And it says, why even a learned person cannot give it up? Because it's such a strong impression. When you come, at the time of death, that impression, when you're going to lose everything that you ever held dear, and if you're not prepared for that, the aversion to it, I don't want to die, will be so strong. It'll make such an impression in the conscious that in your next life, it's there. And even a wise person has a tendency not to get, to just act according to that. Again, when I went to the farm and this Graham was telling me how his father died, and some spiritual. My teacher was not at all affected. I've seen that many, many times. So these are the five underpinnings of all thoughts. All thoughts come from these, and therefore they're the root where the karma comes that binds us in this world. okay, I'm going to be exceptionally kind. Okay, but if you're not, please come here at 2:15. I'm giving you a big... Wait, how much time did I give? I made a mistake.
10-minute break.
What?
10-minute break.
10 minutes, but... Okay? Come, relax, take a nap, rest. And we'll do that, okay? Because this was heavily philosophical, but I hope you're all absorbed in listening.